Welcome to the Free Cities Podcast. My name is Timothy Allen, and this is the official podcast of the Free Cities Foundation. Hello, and welcome to episode number 44 of the Free Cities Podcast. Well, today's show is a conversation I had in Portugal with a couple of Bitcoin OGs by the names of Josh and Zach Harvey. Now, these two brothers were responsible for creating the first ever prototype Bitcoin ATM way back in 2013, an endeavor that has given rise to their market-leading company Lamassu, currently supplying Bitcoin ATMs all over the globe. However, more recently, they have embarked on a rather inspiring regenerative agriculture project in their adoptive country of Portugal. And this conversation helps to reveal some of their motivations and inspirations for not only moving across the globe to a foreign country, but also for immersing themselves in an experimental farming project. Something which I suppose was made even more unusual by the fact that neither of them have any previous experience in that field at all. Or in fact, any fields, I suppose you could say. Boom, boom, I'm here all week. Anyway, there's plenty of advice here if you are thinking about embarking on a food sovereignty project of your own, or in fact, moving to Portugal, which, as you will hear, has many benefits for those looking to move countries in search of a better life. Also, did you know it's exactly 3 weeks today until liberty in our lifetime? We're all starting to get very excited here. In fact, the Free Cities Foundation's decentralized offices are buzzing with activity at the moment, and I can't wait to see you all there in Prague. Failing that, of course, in the meantime, just sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Josh and Zach Harvey. I know that in the Bitcoin community, you know, what you're doing is quite an archetypal thing that's out there. And I find that really interesting because Bitcoin's a funny thing, isn't it? It's like a, you know, it's a bit of technology, essentially, but a strange thing. But what it's given rise to is this culture of people who really value things like what you're doing, which would be this kind of sort of low-tech kind of lifestyle, but with, you know, some essentially high-tech things like thrown in on top. Like you need to have, you know, peer-to-peer digital money, and you need to have, you know, probably a satellite connection to, you know, whatever, you know, and I like that, and I'm intrigued by it, and I think it's something I'd like to talk about. I mean, obviously, do you agree with me first? Do you think that's a fair?
Yeah, I do. I think it does make sense. And I David Friedman yesterday talked about how government feeds off of complexity, right? So the more complex the system, the more you say, oh, well, I can't understand all of this. I need the government to interfere and help this. And when you have simplicity, when you have something that's very basic that anybody can understand, then it's like, oh wait, what is the government contributing here? Why do I even need a third party in this? And so I think that's one of the reasons that Bitcoiners are kind of attracted to this, is you start from the money, right? And you're like, okay, why do we even need these central banks? Why do we need the Federal Reserve? And then if you start applying that to everything else, all of a sudden you start zooming in and you're like, wait, it's the same thing, right? What Bitcoin does for money, you have the same thing with agriculture.
Right. If you talk to a central banker and you're like, why do we need a central bank? It's, oh, it's all very complicated. You know, well, you just print money, right? Oh no, it's much more complicated than that. Let's get into a million terms that an academic made up a year ago, quantitative easing. There are all these like words they're making up. They feed on complexity, like Zach said. And then Bitcoin is 21 million. That's it. It's not gonna change. Everybody can understand that. And right, these bureaucrats don't like that.
Right.
But also, I think it speaks to the decentralized nature of what we of Bitcoin and how we understand that as an important aspect, self-sovereignty, and that self-sovereignty is not just a money thing, it's a lifestyle thing as well. And I suppose the most important one is probably food, when you actually think about it. And it's the one that's had the biggest assault in the real world. I mean, you know, if you think about contemporary life compared to a couple of hundred years ago, you know, not being able to provide for yourself with food is a very new concept, really, in the grand scheme of the human species.
Yeah, and to bring it back to David Friedman, he mentioned today the steps it requires to make a pencil, right? And no one person knows how to make a pencil. No one person has the resources to make a pencil. You need the chainsaws and the fuel and the mining for the metals to make the chainsaws. Turns out, to actually feed yourself, you don't need all those different people. All you need is a little bit of grass and a lamb. And the lamb makes more lambs. With the way we're doing the regenerative agriculture, we don't use any external inputs. We don't use herbicides. We don't use fertilizer. We actually don't need anything from the outside world. We don't even have a barn. We don't have electricity on the farm. We have electricity on the farm because we have, you know, a couple solar panels that are powering the electric fence or something. But we're not actually using electricity from the grid. And, you know, we would be able to somehow make do without that as well.
Maybe we should backtrack a bit and go right back to the start here. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you what I know about you guys. Your brothers, you run a Bitcoin ATM company. Is that the originally?
Yeah, we still do. We
still you still it. Do, yeah. Right, yeah. Right. But about a year ago, you bought, 160 acres of land in southern Portugal. Is that about right?
Pretty much, yeah.
And it had a property on it as well, right?
Yes-ish. Not in good shape. And that's kind of bureaucratically complex. We're still working on the house.
You're living there, though?
No, we're actually living in Lisbon right now. We're still living in Lisbon. It's temporary. Hopefully, we'll get house built in a year or two or three.
Right, but the point of it is, well, tell me what the future of you know, like, what is that place in 10 years' time, for example?
That's a good question. So it's an experiment. That's the first thing. So we're both city boys. We don't have any experience with agriculture. And right now on the farm, we have two full-time farm managers or farmers that studied it in Portugal. And they're some of the few young people that are willing to get their hands dirty and actually work on a farm and not just write reports and also actually interested in what we're doing. So they don't just want to work at a industrial pig farm. They actually are excited by what we're doing. And the first process of the first year is trial and error. We want to try all kinds of things that a lot of the traditional farmers that have been doing things the more modern way the past 100 years are saying won't work. And we want to go back even further and really mimic nature the way we do it. And so go back. And these are things we have to try. So we've seen YouTubes, we've read things, we've heard podcasts, we've read articles, and now we want to go out and try it. But the idea is to regenerate the soil. The idea is to take a piece of land in southern Portugal whose soil is depleted and very few nutrients and very dry and bring it back to health. And that means there will be more food for more animals. And as the years go by, the soil will get healthier and healthier. And the soil will also be more productive because it will grow more grass and food for the sheep, goats, and perhaps cattle to eat.
But is it also a strategy for you guys to be self-sufficient?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
And okay, first question obviously then is, what do the locals think about this? And have you met them all? I mean, you know, like, do you know the guys that live around there and the old farm? I mean, is it a lot of old farms still in existence around there?
It's a really good question. So it's a very rural area. It's a very spread out area. Small, tiny little villages. It's a little bit sad because, as in most of Europe, the population in Portugal is getting very old. And you're seeing that the most in these old rural villages where pretty much everybody is over 60, 70. It's all the old guys living there and remaining there. So that's the kind of people we meet there. And we have a little tiny village, maybe 50 people, right on the tip of the farm. Very, very friendly. They help us a lot. So we know pretty much everybody there. The farmers are talking to them on a daily basis. And then there are lots of other people on the periphery who also are helping. Almost everybody is extremely friendly. There are a few characters that we've had some trouble with, but everybody in the community kind of knows that they're problematic people. So, you know, you would find that anywhere. But as a whole, extremely friendly. They probably think we're a little weird doing things the way we do it. And obviously, none of us are that experienced. They are. They've been doing this for forever, and their parents have probably been doing this for a while, and so they know how to do what they're doing. We don't know how to do what we're doing, and we're trying a different way of doing it.
Can I ask originally then, why Portugal? You're Americans, right?
Right. We were born in the U.S., yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
We grew up in Israel, actually.
Okay. So why did you pick Portugal?
So that started with the Bitcoin ATMs. So we didn't really know anything that much about Portugal. We were in the Free State Project in New Hampshire at the time. And we had just introduced the world's first Bitcoin ATM, which was more of a science project prototype at first. And the reason we created the Bitcoin ATM at first wasn't to start a business. We wanted to take it to actually a Students for Liberty conference and just show people, look at this Bitcoin thing. Like, why are you wasting your time on all these other libertarian things when it's clearly the most impactful thing you could be doing right now? And anytime we just had like a little sign or made these little cards to give out, it wasn't really getting people's attention. They weren't excited about it. And so we're like, okay, we have to demonstrate. And so we built this little orange box out of MDF with the Raspberry Pi and a few components. And we brought that to the International Students for Liberty Conference in DC in 2013. And from the second we brought it was like the hit of the show. Like, everybody was lining up, taking pictures, putting it on social media. We were getting emails from, you know, VCs and that sort of thing within moments. And we're like, okay, let's turn this into a business. And the first thing we had to do was like, okay, we don't know how to design a Bitcoin ATM. Like, it wasn't one of those ATM things we thought about general. As kids, right? It's like, okay, well, we're doing this Bitcoin ATM thing. Where do we start? And so we started just searching the internet for industrial designers, people who knew how to design things from scratch. And we scoured the internet. And the guy we ended up liking the most was a Portuguese guy from northern Portugal named Claudio. And he just gave us amazing designs, and he was really good at answering our questions thoroughly. And just we just got along with him immediately. And so it was obvious that we wanted to work with him. And the most amazing thing that he did is that although we only wanted him for the design at first, and we thought we'd just make like a 3D model, or we're thinking of make one out of carbon fiber. And none of those things, all of our plan A's and plan B's didn't work out in the end. For the one super important conference we needed this for was a Bitcoin conference in 2013 in San Jose. And Claudio got it to us made out of sheet metal in a week, shipped from Portugal. Everything fit perfectly despite not having the components. And it was just that moment, it was like, this guy knows how to get things done. And so we've been working with him ever since. And then we came to Portugal to work on the product and on the production prototype. And came to Portugal for 2.5 months to Porto to work on it with him every day. And just kind of fell in love with Portugal. We didn't move there immediately. In fact, it took about 8 years. We only moved to Lisbon 2 years ago. But that's when we started realizing there's something special about Portugal. And always kind of had it in our minds.
Well, there's a number of Bitcoiners that live in Portugal as well. I think it originally attracted by the favorable tax rules, but they've changed now.
I think that was a lot later. Yes, they have changed. Yeah, yeah. They're not the worst. As it is right now, if you hold on to cryptocurrencies for over a year, you still don't have to pay taxes. Okay. But if you're trading, then you'll get hit.
Before we move on, with regards to the ATMs and stuff, I had a quick flick through your website. You do other stuff now, don't you? It's not just ATMs. There are other, like, bank looking machines and stuff. Like,
well, that is a Bitcoin ATM.
Is it? Oh,
yes,
right.
It is the first bank grade Bitcoin ATM.
Ah.
And what we mean by bank grade, it has tremendous capacity. and tremendous speed. So
what do you mean by capacity?
As far as cash that it can actually hold.
Oh, right. Okay.
Right. So I'll just pretty much, there is a standard more or less of a Bitcoin ATM, let's say a two-way Bitcoin ATM that you can deposit cash and get Bitcoin or send Bitcoin to the machine and get cash. And they usually hold about 1,000 notes for the bill acceptor and about 1,000 notes for the bill dispenser. The bill dispenser usually has a bulk note dispenser, which means that it'll dispense, say, 20 notes at a time. The bill validator, you put in one note at a time, right? So if you want to buy $200, $300 worth of Bitcoin, that's fine. You know, you put in a few 50 notes or 100 notes and you're there. But if you want to put in $5,000 or euros or 50,000, you're going to be putting notes in one at a time for a while. So we designed two new models that we just released now, that one of them is a little smaller and it can accept 50 notes at a time. And the other one is a beast. It can accept 200 notes at a time and it will accept them in 8 seconds.
Wow.
So that's a tremendous amount of money. And that's what I mean by speed. And it can recycle, meaning it can take the same notes that you put in for a deposit to withdraw up to 11,000 notes. So this is a machine that's designed for places that have high volume and where people want to use it for larger amounts. And we think that's going to be a more important market. As we see with Bitcoin, the banks are becoming less and less friendly. And one of the core advantages of Bitcoin ATMs is that the end user does not have to involve his bank when he buys or sells Bitcoin.
You called it bank grade, though. It did make me think, what bank is going to have this machine in there, right?
Yeah.
Are they? Like, no banks have ATM. There's no, they're probably not even anywhere near.
Correct. There was a bank in the Philippines that was...
We had a customer a few years back that was a bank in the Philippines. There are some banks in Switzerland that see it as a cool thing to do once in a while. But it's not a thing, right? They're bankless ATMs, if anything. Yeah. We just like playing around with the word. Maybe too much. Maybe it is confusing to call them bank grade.
Well, it may be one day. Be an optimist. I mean, it might. I wouldn't be. I mean, what instantly springs to mind is, like, you know, say somewhere like Lebanon and having this ATM where people can literally save their purchasing power from an inflating economy by feeding notes and stuff.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, does that happen in real life? Like, do those things exist? Do your ATMs appear in places where people really need them? You know.
Not to that extent yet, unfortunately. Like, the biggest market for Bitcoin ATMs is still North America. We're getting some more interest in South America. We're getting a little bit more interest in Africa, but slowly. So I would say they're developing markets for Bitcoin ATMs, but nowhere near the kind of volume and demand that we see in North America. Yeah. Most of Europe is also lagging way behind. Like, France and Germany are way behind because of the regulatory situation and how they approach innovation. And Portugal is not in great shape. There are a few operators here, not of our machines, unfortunately, but there are a few Bitcoin ATM operators here. And then we have some machines scattered in Spain. We have some machines in Israel, in Asia. But it would be great to see more of these machines in places, as you said, that are experiencing hyperinflation and really need a machine that can handle that.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's enough about ATMs, I think. Let's go on to the good stuff because, well, obviously, I'm interested in this anyway, but the Free Cities crowd in general is a crowd of people that are looking for freedom. And I think one of the ways in which you can do it is the kind of thing that you guys are doing. I know there are no frontiers anymore. Frontiers don't exist. Oh, well, space and the sea, maybe, in places like that. So we kind of, if you want to find a frontier on land, you really have to work within the confines of an existing place. But I think the next best thing is what you guys are doing, which is to get an amount of land and work towards being self-sufficient. So why don't you, I mean, let's be quite specific about this in Portugal. If someone's listening to this and because I know a lot of people, myself included, fantasize about this kind of thing all the time. What are the, like, was it easy to A, find a bit of land, B, purchase it, And then obviously the rest of it, I suppose, you know, right. God knows, you know, not having farmed myself, I would be optimistic that I could do what you guys would do and say, right, look it all up on the internet. But obviously having the help of local people is imperative. But maybe start by saying, how feasible is it for your average person?
It's very easy. Portugal doesn't have any laws about stopping foreigners from buying land like some other countries do. So there's no problem with the foreigner coming in, say, I want this piece of land that I found on the internet, and buying it.
Where did you find it then? What on the internet did you find land?
Real estate website. And so we were working with a consultant at the time that was helping us look at some farms, Portuguese guy. And he happened to find this one. And at first we weren't interested in it because it was a little too far from us. And from Lisbon specifically. And so we were looking for a place that was like an hour and a half away from Lisbon, and this place is a little over 2 hours. But after a few years of looking for the perfect farm, we said this place is as close as it gets to perfect, and it's worth the extra drive.
And it's still on the market 2 years later as well.
Not at that exact farm.
Oh, right, okay.
But there were other farms we were looking for. Some stayed available, some didn't. And this one was probably on the market for a year or so. And there's always something on the market depending on the area. There's stuff all around.
Yeah, you have to be realistic. You can't get everything you want, you know, close to a major city, good price, you know, just the right farm that you're looking for. So you're going to have to probably compromise. So we compromised on having to get further away from Lisbon.
Can I ask how much it was, or like roughly speaking, is it an expensive endeavor?
I can give you the general price of farms in Portugal right now. So per hectare, it's going to be about 7,000 to 10,000 euros per hectare.
Wow, per hectare.
Yeah.
That's 10,000. In the UK now, an acre is £10,000 where I mm-hmm. live. And I live in rural Wales. It's not even, is it highland? You know, is it right. upland?
Yeah.
Sheep only, is it, you know.
So this is, we're an hour away from the Faro Airport and we're 2 hours away from Lisbon and Lisbon Airport. And so the location is pretty good. It's actually 2 hours from Sevilla as well.
Nice. Seville's lovely. So what's the process then you go through, and how long does it take when you purchase?
It's just a matter of, you know, making sure that everything's fine with the property. So we have a lawyer that we work with, and I don't think it took that long, a few months.
It wasn't that complicated. The hardest part is finding the right piece of land, agreeing on the price, and you know, the culture in Portugal is a little different with real estate. The negotiation process is a little strange because
in what way?
they a lot of the people we were talking to got offended at an offer that was lower than what they were advertising for.
Really? My God.
So
this is our family's land.
Exactly.
We can't sell it for less.
Right. So they would rather wait years on the market rather than, you know, reduce the price.
So there's no bargaining on land in
so,
Portugal.
You know, we tried yeah. And we probably got a bit lower, but that was one of the things that was a bit strange to us during the, you know, negotiation with different landowners. The actual legal process, there are some taxes, there are transaction taxes, there are notary fees. But it's a pretty, if there aren't any complications, it's a pretty quick and simple process.
And describe what it was like turning up then the day you'd got the keys, I'd say, but you don't get the keys, do you?
there wasn't really anything.
There were no
keys.
Go on, what's it like then? I want to live vicariously through you. Talk me through it.
Yeah, well, it was terrific. Actually, right after we signed it, we grabbed our lawyer and we're like, all right, let's drive down. I think it was like an hour drive from the notary. And we, of course, had been there many times before checking it out.
Yeah,
it's not the same.
No.
Yeah. It's amazing. Yeah. Walking in your land in really beautiful areas of cork trees and holm oaks and pine trees and natural beauty. And just thinking about what you can do there.
So come on then, what were those thoughts?
Well, at first there was nothing there, right? So at first there was like, okay, this is going to be a lot of work actually.
What do you mean by that though? Are we talking about land that has been left?
Abandoned.
So, abandoned, right. But, you know, I suppose intuitively you could think that that's a good thing for land though, just leaving it and letting, you know.
If it had only been abandoned, then perhaps, yes. But they'd actually allowed for use for feeding cattle, which on the surface of things sounds like a good idea. It's what we want to do. But the nuance is that they would allow herds of 200 cattle that would just go and eat everything to the ground. Right. And that's horrible for the soil. And that's horrible for getting the grasses to grow back. And that causes the soils to be more and more bare. And so we could go in all the reasons of the economies and how that works, but a big part of that reason is that the person with those heads of cattle gets subsidies from the EU for each head. And so they want to just have as many cows as possible and pay somebody some small fee for bringing them over to the land. And just as long as they're fed, that's all that matters. They're going to get their subsidy money.
So have you had to fence your perimeter?
Yes.
Blimey. How many... What is it? A few kilometers?
It was about 3.3 kilometers. My and God. That was only a part... That was just the main area. But there are other areas that we haven't even fenced yet.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that was... It's funny you ask that because we actually had that... We had a trespasser that we called a grass thief. And this was pretty much exactly a year ago of a cow herder with a herd of 200 cows came onto our small farm and... Within weeks, they ate about 75% of the food on our farm.
Wow!
For the entire year.
But was that because he didn't realize that
he did know because we confronted him a few times.
Oh right,
yeah. And so the police in the area do not enforce the rule of law or property as we would like them to, or trespassing laws, and it's been a long and drawn out process, but we definitely had to build the fence.
Yeah. Well, I know that's expensive. Well, at least it is where I live.
It is, yeah. And it's it was, that's a difficult part. Like getting good workmanship in that part of the country is an ongoing challenge.
Right.
Yeah. So talk to me then about your learning journey on all this. I take it you're following the principles of regenerative agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
Which I know as Bitcoiners we hear quite a lot about. I'm always keenly following this movement, where I live, one of my neighbors she's a beef farmer, and I've managed to convince her to sell her beef for Bitcoin, and now she's the market. She's the only person now in the UK.
Wow!
And she, as far as I know, because I bought the domain bitcoinbeef.org, and I said, look, I'm just going to list everyone in the UK who sells, and she's still the only person on the list. So. But you know, it was an experiment that worked phenomenally well. I just said, look, I know a market that you can tap into, and all you got to do is accept Bitcoin. And in the beginning, she said, okay, not really knowing what it was. And now she's a fully fledged Bitcoiner, like a year later.
Amazing.
And she sells now. People are coming saying we want a whole cow. You know, this kind of, you know, selling directly to people, which is what it's all about. Is that something that's in your plan?
Absolutely, 100%.
Yeah.
So we want to sell directly. we'd be happy to sell for Bitcoin, of course, as well. And that's something that we plan to do. We're still at a very early stage as far as that. We have a small herd, and it's kind of I consider it like a proto herd. We're still learning the ropes and figuring out what we have to do to support a bigger herd. Do we have to buy more land, or can we just get more efficient in the land we already have?
When you say small herd, how many heads is that?
We have about 40 sheep and 10 goats.
Really?
Yeah.
On that much land? I mean, in Wales, mind you, we get a lot of juicy grass.
Yeah, that's
there,
all the difference, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You need a lot of land in Portugal. Yeah.
So we think the land can support up to 200, 250.
Right.
But we didn't want to start with that, because if we were wrong, then that would be a disaster.
Right. Yeah. So to put it into context, this is the first year we have animals. Again, we don't have any background in this. Even our farmers have no experience. They went to school, but they don't have actual experience. Handling the animals, maintaining the animals, being in the field with the animals. So we wanted, this was the first part of the experiment where it's not about, you know, how much can the land handle, but it's about learning from the animals and learning if the ideas we have that, despite all the videos and YouTubes and articles we read, those were not focused on our area of the world where we are right now. So we have to try out all these things. And also you never get the full picture. You never get all the details.
So what are the principles then?
So, yeah. So the guiding principle is very, very few inputs. Minimize the inputs as much as possible. By that, I mean any kind of chemical fertilizer, herbicide, and feed from the outside. So we want them to be able to survive on the farm. And another guiding principle is we want them to be able to be outside. So they're outside 24/7 every single day of the year, no matter what. We don't even have a barn at all.
You've got a lot of water supply on there then.
Water isn't really the problem, not at this point, for right. Sure. We have a pond. And the pond, even in the dry environment, the pond exists all year long. It shrinks and then it grows again in the winter. But that always has enough water for the herd. So we have we put down some pipe throughout the farm, and the animals just feed. We pump the water out into drinking containers, and they just drink from that.
Wow! So, and you've been there a year so far.
Yeah.
So, what have been the main hurdles up until this point? Or maybe actually, before we do that, we should probably, is there anything more you want to say about regenerative agriculture? It seems quite simple the way you've just described it. I know it's not, because
The hard parts are the plants. The animals are easy. Right. In general, the animals are easy. Goats have a mind of their own, but the plants are the really tricky things in our environment, because it's extremely dry. We get 350 millimeters of rain on average for the entire year. And most of that is in, you know, a few days in the winter. So the rest of the time it's just dry as a bone. As soon as you start hitting the sun in the summer, everything just dries out completely. And that means it's very, very challenging to grow the grass we need, especially throughout the entire year, to feed that herd, because we don't have to just feed these animals in the spring. We need to feed them all year long, and we have to support them even more when they're lactating, when they're having babies.
Are you buying hay in at all at the moment?
Yes, yeah. Well, one of the reasons we had to buy hay the first year is because of the grass thief.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
So we had to supplement. We would love it if we didn't have to, but hay has a lot of advantages until we figure out how to do everything without hay. And at the same time, we're adding organic matter to the farm. So a lot of time what we'll do in the hay, instead of putting it in a feeder, we'll just put it straight on the ground. And then it doubles as feed and mulch as well. And a lot of times we'll see that there's actually really good growth afterwards where the hay was.
What were they doing before this? What were the farms, the traditional methodology of the farms around there?
Depends how far back you want to go. But
what
past,
are they, all right, what are they doing now, say, like your average?
A lot of them will be growing hay. So they'll till the land, they'll grow hay, they'll grow wheat. The smarter ones will go for some niche market and market to that, or some will have monoculture, olive groves, pine trees, where they get the pine notes for all the for eating. I think even a lot of the pine nuts they use in Italy might be from Portugal, from that area.
Is that right?
Cork as well. So a lot of, unfortunately, there is a lot of monoculture and a lot of modern farming.
But you're sticking to meat?
Yes, and meat and dairy.
So, okay. Talk me through the apart from thieves stealing your grass, this is a good basis for a fly on the wall documentary, isn't it? It's like, especially when things like that happen.
Yeah.
My mind instantly goes to, oh, that would be a really interesting episode of this.
Well, we were watching the show Yellowstone. Yellowstone was some
1923 or something.
Yeah.
They have all stories of grass thieves all around, all throughout
there was
history.
One
it's
episode
very
of,
what
of
is
the
it?
Actual, they actually called him the grass thief after we had already named our guy the grass
what
thief.
What is Yellowstone?
Yellowstone is an American TV show about a farm that's been in this family for generations.
In Montana.
So it starts like with the first pioneers coming, and then it comes all the way through to modern day, and it stars Kevin Costner.
It's not a documentary.
It's not a documentary, but I think it's based on an actual family.
If you care about farming, it's fun to watch just for those sorts of... I wouldn't say I consider it a very high-quality TV show, but it is enjoyable.
So you consider yourself farmers now? You're into
not
farming?
Entirely. We're experimenters at this point, and once we move down there and they're full time, maybe then I'll feel comfortable calling myself a farmer. Kind of like if you play guitar, you're not a guitarist just yet.
Right. Well, some people don't think like that actually. Some people like pick up a guitar and go, right, I'm a guitarist now. It's a mindset, and it's like a fake it till you make it thing, isn't it?
Well, we're definitely trying to fake it till we make it.
Okay, so what are the other big hurdles then that you've come across in your first year?
Food is definitely a big part of it. Understanding how, like the dryness in general and the heat of the farm. So, for example, what we do is rotational grazing, but it's daily rotational grazing. So we have smaller paddocks with a whole herd, and we move them every single day. And that keeps the food fresh for them, and it moves them away from their fertilizer as well. So there's never a time where they're in an area too long and the flies start coming in, and that could lead to disease. And one of the cool things about that is that it never smells like a farm. You walk around the animals, nothing smells bad. It just smells like nature.
It actually smells fragrant because in those dry areas you have a lot of aromatic plants. So you have these kind of, it smells like perfume.
Right.
And they always walk through them. Right. And so... We need to move these electric fences every day, which in Wales would be super easy because it goes straight into the ground. And here during the summer, you try that and it'll bounce right back. It's as hard as a rock. And so there were some people we talked to early on. It's like, you can't do that kind of fencing. You can't do your plan in southern Portugal. It just won't work. And they said the poles won't go in to the... into the ground. You have to have permanent fencing all around the farm, which first of all would make it really ugly.
And
that's very expensive.
Prohibitively expensive.
Exactly. So one of the experiments we did is we said, well, what if we just drill into the ground?
Hmm.
And so the first time we tried that, we bought a regular drill and it didn't work well. And then Josh found out that there's a better kind of drill for this, which is a hammer drill.
So it's used for like drilling into concrete.
Right.
I know.
And so we got this
beefy Bosch hammer
drill that can go right through rock, and it takes anywhere between 10 to 20 seconds. And so you just, and it works perfectly.
And they're there and again, then, when you come back, they're still
yeah,
there.
Yeah, you have,
no, I mean, if, no, if you, after a few weeks, it'll be gone.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You can't use it again. But.
Yeah. But we have our 23-year-old petite farmer girl who goes in basically with it strapped on her, and she'll just do, you know, in a minute, she'll do a bunch of them. So it's not something that's hard that you need to be strong for. The drill does all the work, and all of a sudden you turn an environment that's very difficult to do this kind of plan, and there are hardly any YouTubes about how to do, you know, daily rotational grazing in areas with soil that hard. We looked for all of them.
Sure.
Couldn't find anything.
Well, that's what I was going to say, because from what I know of that method, Joel in you know...
Yeah.
I probably know it all from what he said. And I've always thought, the way I see it is like, because they've got a lot of lush grass there. So when you move them on, it gives the grass a chance to sort of come back up. But when you talk about the kind of earth you get down in Spain, is there any, you know, regeneration? Like in the heat of the summer, when you move your animals on, does it work? You know,
there is not a lot of regeneration in the summer. And you get, I mean, there's obviously there's tons of sun. There's just no water in the summer, and so it gets really hot. The regeneration comes in from October to around May.
Right. And the reason to move them on is because if they stayed in the same place, they would decimate it to the point where it wouldn't.
Exactly.
Right. Okay.
So we keep the grass at about, you know, 50% of its full height, maybe 40%. And then it's fertilized as well. They fertilize it and then they move on. And then if it does grow back, then they have more food to come to. And if it's slower to grow back, then either you have to supplement with hay, or you go to a different part of the farm and you wait till October comes, and then it will come back.
And is it 1 year rotation? Like one bit of land gets eaten once per year?
No. In the spring, and when in the wet, rainy season, you want to move them around a lot. You want to give the grass enough time to grow back to its optimal height. There's a kind of a range of a blade of grass where it's doing its fast growth. So you don't want to mow it down too close to the ground, but you don't want it to get too high either. So as long as you're keeping it in that range, you want to keep moving them back every few months.
Where do your shepherds live? You said you got two.
Yeah.
Where do they live?
They have a rental house in the small village that's adjacent to the farm. So they're 2 minutes away.
So are they from farming families?
One of them is. The other one I don't believe is, but they're both actually from the north. So our farmer Christiana lives in a village that she would have to spend all day getting to. Even though Portugal's a pretty small country, once you figure in public transportation and in the buses, it takes her about 5.5 hours to get back. And so at one point she almost just like gave up and she goes back for holidays. She's gotten really into it and really used to it, and she'll be on the farm for weeks straight.
So none of the shepherds, I can call them shepherds, can't I? They are shepherds.
They don't actually do a lot of herding. They just open the fence and the sheep and the goat are like,
they're just waiting for it. They're just waiting to move. That's another actual important part of rotational grazing that maybe isn't talked about that much, but I think it has huge benefits for the animals' mental well-being. They love moving. They don't like staying in one place forever. And they don't like, being just spread out. They like being in a herd that's moving. And they really, really look forward to moving to the next paddock every day.
I mean, I've spent a lot of time in Mongolia.
Wow.
And I know that it very intimately, because I visit one family at least two times a year, and I travel with them as well. And I know very intimately the life of a free herd of, in their case, mainly sheep and goats. But it's totally true. And in fact, the method you're using, I watched a film a few years ago about the Alps. It's the same. They don't move them. They move up in the summer.
Into the mountains.
But it's the same thing. You have to fence, and then you leave them there for a bit, and then you move up, and then the fence. The Mongolian method has no fences. They move. They actually move. They live in tents. That's even closer
to the natural state, right?
And that's very impressive. Yeah. Right. Yeah. I would say that the people we have at the farm are not experienced shepherds yet. So they're not very good at moving the animals around. It's not intuitive to them yet. We still have a lot to learn as far as that's concerned, but they do what's necessary. If we do have to move the animals from one part of the farm to the other, it gets done and we learn every time. Most days, they don't have to do anything except just take one fence out, let the animals run to the fresh grass, they love it, and then to build more fences or collect fences, and they'll do that. And what we'd like to do is have as little human intervention as possible on the farm. We want to do as little work as possible.
I've spent a lot of time with nomadic families in various parts of the world, and what you discover is they corral animals, but really what they're doing is following animals. Mm. Like in Mongolia, for example, during the very cold times is the lowlands, and in summer it's up to the lush grass in the mountains.
Yeah.
And the horses especially know where to go. You don't herd them. They go there naturally, and they've been doing it backwards and forwards. I've been with the nenets in Siberia. That's the largest actual migration of any sort of peoples, I think it's a 2,000 kilometer round trip. They have a huge, I was with a family that had a herd of 700 reindeers.
Amazing.
But they follow them. It's not, it looks like you're kind of, corralling them, but it's not. You're following them. I think in the Mongolia, it's a little bit more like corralling because there's more people and there's places you've got to go to specifically. But it's the natural way of being.
Exactly.
And I think, we invented sedentary agriculture, but trying to mimic it must obviously be the best way of doing it. I'm wondering, on your farm, how do you decide where they go next? Do you just let them out and see where they go, or have you got a kind of route that you've planned out on the land?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, we kind of draw it out and try to see where's the best grass right now. Where are they? Sometimes we do something called strip grazing, where we just take a strip across the farm, and then we just go from paddock to paddock to paddock and then back. And then if we get to a paddock where there's not enough food for whatever reason, then maybe we'll skip it for a period of time and go to the places where there's better grass and then come back at a later point.
How often are you guys going down there?
Once a week.
Really?
Yeah.
And I mean, are you camping down there or what?
Most of the time we actually drive from Lisbon in the morning. We get up at like 4:30, 5 a.m., drive down and drive back in the afternoon. So
you're not into camping? I would have thought that would have been amazing. I just up a tent somewhere nice down by the lake.
I've toyed with it, but haven't done it yet. It would be interesting.
Like I say, going back to Mongolia, 38% of them are still fully nomadic.
Yeah.
You know, they live in under canvas.
They have to get a yurt. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm not being funny, but it's a very convenient way of living because they're you can set up a yurt, or in Mongolia they're called gers. You can set one up, and as long as you're using it, but in a really dry environment like here, you're not going to run the risk of it going moldy or anything, which are the main problems.
Maybe in the
you
winter.
Get. But once you know how to do it and there's a group of you, our guys can put up a gear in 20 minutes, if it's a full group of us and a family and everyone helping. But I just, when I think of that, I instantly think of, God, they're surprisingly easy to live in. You don't have to crouch down, you live it.
Right, right. It's not like a tent. It's more like
a house. No. It is. Yeah. And you can probably get one for $3,000 or secondhand, even probably less. There's always people selling them.
We have looked on the internet for that sort of thing. Right. Tents and yurts and played with the idea. It's always kind of like a back and forth of, okay, why are we doing this exactly?
Well, to be there on site, and also not to just drive so far and have to come back.
Right.
I mean, imagine waking up. And there's the herd. There's the
I mean, I'm so there was a week where we had a different farmer at the time. We had one farmer who's been with us the whole time, Christiana. There was another farmer who had been with us, but then he left for another job, and Christiana was alone at the farm for
weeks.
Several weeks. And we realized that was too much, and she hadn't gone back and seen her family. She's like, we're going to take over by ourselves for a week, me and Zach. And we weren't sure, we know what we were doing. We had never actually been at, taking care of the farm by ourselves for a week with nobody around. But we just said, we'll do it, and she left, and we were there. And we had the time of our lives, actually. I mean, everything was great.
Yeah.
And
where were you staying?
We were staying at her apartment. We rent an apartment for the farmer. So since she left, it was empty.
And how far is that from the ground, the land?
It's about 50 meters.
Really?
Yeah. So 2 minutes.
Wow.
Well, less.
When you say apartment, though, it makes me think
it's a house.
It's a little house. Right. Yeah, talk to me about the buildings you've got, the derelict ones. Are they,
So we have, in that same village, there are two houses that are falling apart that are adjacent to the farm, but not on the farm. And one of the problems with them is that there's a rule in Portugal that if you do not own the land behind your house, you're not allowed to have any windows on that side.
Even if it's looking over nothing.
Right, right. Which it is. Which it's an empty field.
It's an empty field. And the only problem is that there's a tiny strip of land behind those houses that's owned by two old sisters who have been arguing amongst themselves for decades about whether to sell or not and can't come to an agreement. And so if we were just able to buy that small strip of land, which would not have been expensive, then at least we'd be able to have windows looking at, have a nice view towards the end and not just have one side with the windows, which is the side where there's like a little, not so pretty road that it would be looking at. And so it's not the ideal place to build a house for us. We also have some building rights that, interestingly enough, we only found out about as we were signing the contract, which is enough to probably build about 5 to 7 houses on the farm.
Is that how they issue? I mean, so you can, what is it like a?
It's about zoning. So because the tip of the land is kind of near
the village,
somebody drew a circle. And that circle includes about a third of a hectare of farmland, which is zoned as urban. So we have rights to build houses there.
But you still have to apply to build a house.
Engineering. Yeah. You don't have to get it zoned. You have the rights to build houses there. So it's just like building any other house anywhere in the country where you need to get the engineering approved. Right. But there's nothing that's going to stop
you. But for us, it's like a potential community in the future if we want to use it there. It's really cool because it's actually on the farm, but it's also the part of the farm that's right near the village, which isn't the heart of the farm. So you're not going to have the same kind of views that you would have on the farm. But in order to build the house on the farm and get the good views, you have to prove that you're a farmer, which is a lot of bureaucratic work, which we've been working on forever, and it's just going to take a while. And if we do get the license approved to build a house inside the farm, then that would be ideal. Then you'd be on a hill, and you'd see a lot of the farm, and it would just you'd kind of just be surrounded by it, which is much nicer.
Yeah, and what are you into, like, you know, modern buildings and passive technology and all that kind of, you know?
Actually, the opposite. What we're getting into, one of the things we're most excited about now is rammed earth.
Oh, right.
So really old buildings. And I really like the style of the old Alentejo building, which is very, kind of very
minimalist. Is that adobe, do they call that? Is that?
I think it's different. Probably. It's different. It's related because it's all kind of mud-based. But I don't know that much about adobe, but rammed earth is... you're basically taking dirt, adding some water, and tamping it down. So it's creating compacted.
How do you make a wall?
Yeah, you have these molds on each side. Like wooden molds or usually wooden molds, and then you're just putting the soil into there. But it has a lot of big advantages for our area. It's very... it has very good insulation qualities, and it's pretty easy to do. And it's, from an environmental standpoint, you're not importing any kind of foreign plastics or weird chemicals. So it's all, you're just taking it,
you
soil.
Can, yeah, and from and your if own
you're
land
ever,
as
if
well.
You ever, yeah, I think we can. It's you have to do kind of a soil analysis to see if you have the right stuff. You might have to get some extra clay or something, but it's very easy. And it's if you ever knock down the house, it's just dirt.
Is it? So that's the traditional method.
And that's another thing which ties into this philosophy of self sustainability. I mean, if you can build a house, it's just the wall, so it's not the whole thing. But if you can build a house just based on soil from the land itself, I mean, that's a lot better than having to import tons of high-tech materials from who knows where.
Hmm. Freeze blocks, probably. Wow. So how many houses are there in the village currently?
That's a good question. Probably about 10, 15.
And everyone...
Some of them are in really bad shape, but some of them, there are people living them.
And is there a cafe in the middle or anything like that?
Not in this one. Yeah.
There's about a 5-minute drive away. There's a cafe, and in the other direction, another 5 minutes, there's a cafe, but nobody shows up. So you won't actually get your coffee.
Right.
But we actually, after that, we bought another smaller farm in order to get better houses, in order to have better housing options. And one of them, so our region is right on the border of the Alentejo region of Portugal and the Algarve. And so there's kind of a ravine that goes in. There's like a river that goes by, and it really changes the view from just being flat to all of a sudden you have this huge ravine. Well, it appears that way, and a beautiful view. And one of the houses is facing exactly that. So it's one of those houses that you just see and you're like, okay, this is what it should be like.
Is it derelict?
Yes.
So you're buying derelict houses.
Right.
There's no problem regenerating derelict houses.
No. So, well, we had to get, there were two houses on that property. And there was one that's more attractive and one that was a little less attractive because of where it's situated. It's on the other side of the road. And one of them we had to get legalized. And so that took a few months and was annoying, but now we have two legalized houses and we can tear them down and build one instead, even, you know, 20, 30% larger, and there's no problem with that.
And so what's the long-term plan then?
The long-term plan is to move to the farm and to have those houses, small vineyard, mostly for ourselves, some fun fruit trees, and to just watch the herd grow and watch to see how this project goes along. Are we actually able to improve the soil over time? Are we able to get grasses that have deeper roots and can reach further to find water and grow even and more and have larger herds and potentially have more animals, cows, geese, grow some honey?
What about the ATMs? Is in someone parallel, else going to do that?
Well, we have another project even besides that. We have the medical clinic in Lisbon.
Well, tell me about that.
So we, just this past year, we opened a medical clinic that focuses on root cause medicine, which is really trying to figure out why are people ill in the first place? Why are we so unhealthy? Why is it so hard for us to maintain health when with all the technology we have today, we should be the healthiest ever? And instead, it seems like we're going the opposite direction, especially in like places like the US with the obesity epidemic. It's unbelievable that with all the technology we have, we're harming ourselves in these ways.
So at that clinic, did you have to find some sort of special doctors or something?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We had to find a doctor that was special.
Go on. In what
and
way?
It took us a while and it took us more than one try, but we have an amazing doctor. She's young. She's in her early 30s and she's just finished her specialization in oncology. And she's on the same page with us, and she's believed this for a very long time. And so, in a real sense, we found each other. Like, she was looking for something, really got tired of just doing, you know, just being at a regular hospital and doing all the regular hospital stuff and treating people just according to the guidelines, meeting people with 5 to 7 minutes and sending them out with a prescription when she knows there's more that she can do to keep these people healthy.
And how do you find clients for this thing? Huh?
It's hard, and it's a challenge, but so far our success has come through our Instagram page, and so we do a lot of videos on Instagram. There is one influencer here in Portugal, in the north of Portugal, and she's actually originally from Brazil, and fortunately for us, she loves us and she loves what we're doing, and she's popular. She has over 100,000 followers, so she's been promoting us at every chance possible.
Is that the farm as well, though? When you say promoting you, is this a package?
No, it's not. They stem from the same place.
Yeah.
Right. We're looking at the root cause of human health and the root cause of agricultural health or environmental health, and so it's the same concept of why are we doing things wrong? This doesn't make any sense. Let's try doing things the obvious and simple way. And so they come from the same place of why do we not know what to eat and why aren't we healthy? And let's try to figure this out. But they are very separate projects with different people.
They're both low time preference strategies, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. I mean,
They're not putting a bandage on it. They're thinking long term, right? How do we fix this forever?
Yeah. And I think, even Bitcoin, it's people are understanding that it takes a lot longer than they had hoped, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You think, oh, I have this amazing currency, magical internet money, and so everybody's just going to realize it's awesome and we win. Mm-hmm. And it takes a very long time. And that's one of the most impressive things about Bitcoin is that it's still around 10 years later, still going strong. And that's what you need to win. You need to stick it out for a very long time.
Talking of Bitcoin, have you spoken to any of the people in the vicinity of the farm about Bitcoin?
No, not really.
Yeah.
It might be a little early for that. We talked to
a little late.
Yeah,
actually.
I mean, we talked to for all of our employees, they get a bonus if they accept payment, earn their salaries in Bitcoin.
Nice.
And so we tell them all about that. anybody that wants, we go ahead and we buy them a hardware wallet. And we try to educate them on that and tell them why it's important and get them involved with that. But it hasn't come to the point where we just go in, you know, to the restaurant that we like going to and say, hey, start accepting Bitcoin or we'll stop coming here.
You're not trying to orange pill them around there.
No, haven't done that.
Trying to green pill them on the farm first.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. But it's, I mean, for us, it's all part of this big picture, really, yeah. of, as you put it, low time preference, like really thinking about the long term and being skeptical about these narratives and of all of the interference from the state, whether it's subsidies, whether it's public health guidelines, or whether it's central banks. These things do not make sense. Their predictions have been wrong over and over and over again. And when you're libertarian, you start seeing that the libertarians have actually have amazing foresight. Like the things they've libertarians have been talking about for decades have always come true, right? And you see these examples with inflation, and you see this with COVID, and everywhere you look, it's the same thing. It's like, oh, well, you know, we should be paranoid about government policies. And so being able to be in a project where you can, in your own way, stand up to that and be controversial and offer an alternative to what's being offered by either the state or the private companies that benefit from the state, whether it's through subsidies or regulation or anything else, for us, that's where the fun is. Mm. Like, that's where we get to talk to people about the real deal, like the real free market.
Well, like you say, a lot of Bitcoiners do mention things that end up becoming far more well known about. And I think one of the latest ones is food security. I saw the meme arising a few years ago, you know, and it's like you see all these things happening. And I think COVID, and especially the lockdown aspect of COVID, was a massive wake-up call for people, because they saw things disappear from the shelves of shops. Mm-hmm. Really saw it, you know, not like heard about it, but everyone experienced that. Everyone experienced an empty shelf. And that made you either start become a prepper or start thinking, you know, I mean, digging the land, growing a bit of stuff just in case. And that's what I love, that aspect of Bitcoin. It was such a surprise to me, because it's quite a technological thing, and then you've got this kind of like freedom loving group of people who seem to be creating a parallel society slowly. I mean, I talk to a lot of people, and fortunately, Bitcoiners often have capital at their disposal if they've been, you know, around long enough. And you could argue that that's an ongoing process as well. And it makes sense that once again, they're maybe at the sharp end of the wedge. That's a part of the movement that's gonna take hold. I think so. Anyway, I mean, I just wish I'd started doing it before I had a family, because uprooting your family is the hardest part of this kind of concept. But we do live in farming area, so it's not the end of the world, you know.
Yeah, you could start small. I mean, absolutely, you don't need a lot of land.
Well, we only have 3/4 acre.
Yeah,
and well, it's garden mainly. But yes,
we have chickens, you know.
Yes, yeah, sure.
Sheep, they don't take that much. If you only have a few of them, they don't take a lot of land, especially if you get a lot of rain and you get a lot of grass.
Which we do. Yeah. I mean, it's absolutely lush up where we live. But I agree. And I think, plant vegetables become part of the mix there.
Absolutely.
I think the move to actually animals, because I know, because all my neighbors are animal farmers, either sheep or you know, cows. That's a different kettle of fish. And the terribly annoying thing about raising animals in the UK is how much interference from the state happens. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, I think the state thinks farmers are going to, you know, be nasty to their animals and treat them badly. And the exact opposite appears to be true where I live. They're all small farms. People really take care of their animals. And then, but they have to tag everything. They have to do this. They have to do that. They have to take it to this particular abattoir. They have to you know, they can't ship it to the local abattoir because it went out of business. Because so now they have to drive.
You know why the local one went out of business? Because of all the regulations.
Yeah, yep. Exactly.
Right.
Same thing happening.
Same exact
us,
thing yeah. here. Like, some of our sheep have like 3 tags in each ear.
Yeah.
And we're like, why does this have to be done? Oh, yeah. Well, there are all these different associations. Yeah. Like, can't they agree on one small tag?
Yeah.
And why are they so big? So it's as if you have the state or the local government trying to protect the animals from the farmer, they end up doing most of the harm.
Yeah.
And as you said, they shut down anything from like slaughterhouses, right? So
they centralize slaughterhouses.
Right, centralize.
Like, yeah.
And then you have to drive these animals on a truck for much longer distances.
Yeah.
So the last day or two of their lives are even more miserable.
Yeah. And like I say, because of my time in Mongolia, I've seen it in its authentic state, which is you're driving your animals, you're corralling them. When you need to eat in the summer, obviously you can't preserve anything. So you take an animal, you kill it respectfully and quickly, you skin it and it gets eaten.
Right.
And that's how, you know, that's how it should be, obviously, you know. But yeah, when I talked to Kate, my local farmer who sells for Bitcoin now, it's all about, it's like the state is like moving in. And before long, you know it, because you can see even in the ESG rhetoric, it's like, now meat's not, it's quite a part of popular meme now, meat's not good.
Right,
you know?
You'll eat bugs and you'll be happy.
Right, but it's worse than that. It's going to be like, okay, the price of meat's going to go up, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
For various reasons. And if it's not just the market that does it, it's going to be taxes.
Right.
Just like, okay, we don't want you driving your car because it's bad for the environment, so we're going to tax fuel or we're going to tax cars or whatever. It's going to be the same with meat.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's, I don't know, God, leave people alone. I'm it's so annoying.
It's infuriating.
Really. And like, right. it's this complete lack of trust in humans to do what's right.
Well, the people who are doing this, they just want to control everybody.
Sure.
And they've also always been wrong about it.
Right. Yeah.
All of these policies, they've been wrong about. Things are not getting better going according to their plans.
Yeah.
Right? It leads to, like you, I'll just give you one example of subsidies in Portugal. You have subsidies for olive trees, right? So you'll have these big Spanish corporations that come into Portugal, buy big pieces of land, and they'll just do super high-tech, modern agriculture olive trees, high yield. And, you know, an olive tree is supposed to last for 50 to 100 years or so, some cases even more. These trees are 10 years, they cut them down and they grow new ones.
Yeah.
The soil around there is absolutely dead. If you drive by, instead of seeing an area that's teeming with life and getting bugs hitting your windshield, nothing, it's sterile.
Mm-hmm.
It's just basically empty land, void of nutrients, where they plant their trees, irrigate, synthetic fertilizer, get paid for each tree, cut them down, do it again, and then market it as natural.
Organic.
Sometimes even organic.
It's literally the case for decentralization. It's so the devolving of all this stuff.
Right.
It seems so obvious in so many ways. And I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, are you hopeful personally?
Yeah.
I think as an entrepreneur, you have to be kind of irrationally optimistic. And also you see like, there are lots of rules, and sometimes there are ways to get around them, and you can still operate and do as much as what you can within the framework. And a lot of times, it's more than you thought you can do. And also, you meet these people on the ground. So, you know, we haven't talked to our neighbors about policies or anything yet, but over time, you start getting to know the community. And that's where you get, you know, a little bit more ability to see, you know, what do they think of these policies?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in the end, enough people have to care and stand up and push back in little ways and big ways to change this. And the more you know about how everything is working because you're actually doing it and you know the other people doing it, the more you can do stuff like that.
Right. And in Portugal, especially in our region, there's a very strong culture of black pig and cheeses and sheep, And it would destroy the entire culture if they were to remove meat. And it would, if they destroy the culture in Alentejo, there's nothing left. And so it would be suicide for Portugal to do that right now. And I think that what worries people the most in that area is probably demographics. Everybody's getting old. It's hard for me, if things continue the way they are, especially with Portugal's birth rate, which is about 1.3 per two parents right now. If they don't get more younger people, and younger is anything under 70 at this point, in those regions doing old school farming, whether it's what we're doing or maybe, you know, a bit more modern slash conservative, they're happy. And so one cute story I have is that we were looking for an apartment and they told us to go look for an old woman in a cafe, owner of a cafe called Dona Piedad. And we went there with Cristiana, who's 23. And as we walk in, the woman's like, goes to Cristiana. It's like, I've seen you before. I know you. I saw you on the bus 2 weeks ago. And Cristiana's like, what? How? You just saw me on the bus and you remember me? It's like, I can't remember, you know, she didn't say I can't remember you, but she's like, oh, that's really sweet. And the only reason she remembered her is because it's so rare to see a 23-year-old girl coming in to this region that 2 weeks later, she knew exactly who she was. And it just lit up her eyes talking to her. And our neighbors, which are a little older, invite her over for lunch all the time. And so I think that, first of all, Portuguese are not very xenophobic compared to other people. They're very kind and warm people. And I think if they see people, including foreigners, coming in and actually contributing to their area and bringing some life back into it, that they'll be very happy about it. Because all they see now is all the youth draining into Lisbon and the big cities.
Do you have a sense of any... Do you have any sense that there's people coming back? I mean, like what you're doing, for example, I would say probably the tip of the wedge, yeah. You know, the sharp end of
it's,
the wedge.
It's at the beginning of it. We've met some people, mostly foreigners. We met another Israeli who's doing it not too far from us with a food forest, so no animals yet. And I know there are foreigners. There's some Finnish family not too far from us that we haven't met, but have heard about. There's not a lot. It's the early days. But I think for anybody that's thinking of doing something like this, it's an amazing place for it. We're really kind people, amazing and rich culture. The food is, at least in my book, just the best, period. Like, I can't imagine better food than you have in the Alentejo region in Portugal, plus the wine. And so you really, I think it's a great opportunity, if you can, to find a place that's not too expensive. You can get smaller farms than ours. You can get bigger farms than ours. The real estate isn't too expensive, and there's just so much option because there's so many opportunities because there aren't enough people doing it. And it's really valuable, and the opportunity to take land that is depleted of nutrients right now, and it's a huge challenge, but on the other hand, there's a lot to improve, right? If you go to an area where it gets a tremendous amount of rain, it's going to be harder to see improvement.
A bit of a boring question. How easy is it to get residency here or whatever? What have you got?
Really easy. So there are a lot of people that think, oh, we have to get the golden visa to do this. We have to buy a lot of property, invest, you know, several hundred thousand dollars into, you know, some kind of investment firm. In reality, if you have 5,000 to 8,000 euros in your bank account, that's enough.
You don't have to move them anywhere. You just have to show that you're self-sufficient.
For moving to Portugal and having residency.
Really?
Yeah, you have to actually live here.
You have to live here. Yeah. Unlike the golden visa, right, where you don't, under this you actually have to live here.
And what do you get, a card, like an ID card?
Yeah, you get a residency card. Yeah. In fact, our first one was for 2 years. And our second one, we just went on the internet, pressed a button, get another 3 years.
And the next one is permanent.
Yeah. And then you can get citizenship like
a year later or so.
Wow.
Yeah. So there aren't a lot of, like, we've had residency in Bulgaria. We've had residency in Switzerland. Both were a lot harder. Here was relatively straightforward, easy. They don't have a problem with it. Like, they're very welcoming to people that, at least people that can sustain themselves.
Sure.
Which in Portugal, like, the cost of living is very low, especially for Western Europe.
I think it's one of the lowest, actually, around.
Right.
Yeah, I always notice that, even the price of a coffee.
Yeah.
You know,
definitely the price of a coffee.
But you know what I mean?
In Alentejo, it's 60 euro cents.
Right, 60 cents. That's a big deal. You know, I think it's a good marker, that the price of a coffee in a shop. And, you know, like, what are we now? Back home, we're up to almost £4, £3.50 for a coffee.
Yeah, you know, Switzerland levels.
Right. It's but you
probably
know,
more in Switzerland now than when we were there.
Yeah. Anyway, well, look, this is a great conversation. I find what you're doing super inspiring. And like I say, I'm a tad jealous, I suppose, because I know I probably couldn't ever actually do that because I have responsibilities. But
You can bring your family down to our farm and maybe that'll convince them.
Well, funnily enough, during the lockdowns, we went traveling and we spent 2 months in Spain down near Cadiz. But I know it's if you go east of Seville, if you go along the coast, and we lived on a farm there. It was like a 3,000 acre farm. It was a giant, proper, you know.
Okay.
I've been trying my hardest, but I know it's not going to happen, and I've made my peace. But I can certainly live vicariously through people like yourselves. So good luck with everything. And I know you probably don't need luck. I think you've got it all under control. So.
Oh, I mean, we always need luck. things can go. Yeah, like with the farm, you know there are going to be challenges. You never know what they're going to be. And so luck is always welcome in everything in entrepreneurship. A lot of it is luck.
Well, good luck anyway. And thanks for coming in and sharing your story. And I suppose if anyone is listening to this and they're like, damn, I want to go and do that. Where would you point them to?
Right now, well, I wish we had a website.
You haven't got a website.
We do for the other projects.
Right.
So for Lamassu, we have a website, which is lamassu.is. And for the clinic, we have peru.pt.
You don't have even a page for the farm.
No, but I do have.
We actually did our logo for this conference.
So we're close.
So yeah.
But you could reach out to me on Twitter.
Okay,
it's probably the best place. Just
I'll put it all in the show notes.
Yeah, at zharves.
Okay, excellent. Well, great. Thanks for talking, and good luck.
Yeah. Thanks. Real
Thanks
pleasure.
So much. It was a lot of fun.